You're listening to The Positive Professional with me, Tracy Yvonne.
Today's episode is sponsored by Ivy Elite Training. Are you looking for low-cost online personal development workshops? Topics including diversity and inclusion, health and wellness, work-life balance, emotional intelligence, and more. Visit www.ivyelitetraining.com. Again, that's www.ivyelitetraining.com.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to season two. I am super excited to start season two, and I'm even more excited to kick off this season by interviewing the one and only Dr. LaShawn Paul, who's a fellow licensed social worker. Today, we're going to be talking about social media and its effect on social work practice. So, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for doing this. And I will say, for full transparency, we did attempt this interview before and I saw it recorded and it did not. So for those who are listening today, that means that it's successfully recorded. So thank you again. So Dr. Paul, tell us about yourself and tell us where you were educated and why did you want to become a social worker?
As you mentioned, I'm a licensed clinical social worker in New York City, and I am the owner and lead clinician at Social Work Diva, where I provide mental health therapy, consultation to mental health organizations and to local politicians in order to shape and shift mental health agenda, and clinical supervision to my fellow social workers. I wanted to become a social worker at the age of 17. One of my friends died by suicide, and I realized I didn't want anyone to feel isolated and alone. It was pretty much opportunity to get into the field of therapy and be able to provide in that space.
Thank you. Now, you had shared something on social media that I saw a couple of weeks ago, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation. It's what I really want to do a deep dive today about is how social media, how it's changed how we practice, right, as social workers, licensed therapists, psychologists, because social media is here, it's ever evolving, but now you have other platforms, and what does that mean for how we practice and the ethics behind doing it? So I think you shared on one of your social media pages, and it was saying, I don't know who needs to hear this, but it was basically saying, like, social media platforms are not therapy.
Absolutely. Social media is therapeutic, but not necessarily a replacement for actual therapy with professional mental health providers. I'm a firm believer that while social media can necessarily be a good thing, sometimes it can necessarily be a bad thing, right? It can offer information that is inaccurate or overgeneralize someone's personal experience for everyone that has maybe a particular diagnosis. And that can be very dangerous, right? Oftentimes, people who need psychotropic medications will see messages on social media that is still stigmatizing and ultimately teach them non-traditional ways, right? Or other alternatives in order to prevent or stop their mental illness, when in all actuality, those things can be very harmful for individuals who need medication and therapy.
So when we're thinking about, like, providing information to the general public, would you say that, yes, that that's good for that to be on social media in reference to resources, things that are coming from organizations that are valid? Those are important, right? But when you think about using it to provide somewhat therapy where people can start to ask questions, or if you can kind of get into explaining, you know, what are the concerns in reference to confidentiality? So for an example, as you know, I am on Clubhouse, still on Clubhouse, I guess, when this actually airs. I know that you are no longer on Clubhouse, and I wanted to get your perspective because I've seen a lot of rooms with various topics on Clubhouse. And a lot of times it's inviting people to come into rooms. And for those who are listening, who may not be familiar with the app, it's an audio-based app. So you have several rooms and you can kind of hop in and out of rooms and there's different topics. But there's always a list of the topics. And I've seen a lot of rooms where people are inviting people to come in and share their trauma, to share their personal experiences. And these are people who, some are licensed professionals and some are not.
And I just wanted to get your perspective on that. Let's start where you started first, right? So absolutely. If it's a reputable organization or mental health experts that are sharing information, such as events or other things that people can attend, right? It's great to meet people where they are, and people are on social media, right? Mm-hmm. The thing is, like I mentioned, the information has to somewhat be accurate, right? Evidence-based information, not just someone's opinion. The thing about confidentiality on social media is you kind of really give that up, right? The right to privacy, and that's in therapy, that's a big deal, right? We're bounded by code of ethics for us, both social workers, by the NASW code of ethics. And one of the things that we must protect, right, is confidentiality. And we can't really do that in any type of space, in Clubhouse or on Instagram. Those spaces don't necessarily provide that, right? Because people can follow, just click your name or your username and get to your page and see your entire life, right? There's so many areas that aren't necessarily protected, such as your identity when you're on these places. The thing about being able to just kind of like share your trauma or your pain, it's kind of dangerous, right? And it's one of the reasons why for me, Clubhouse, I didn't feel necessarily was a good space. Obviously, people can give disclaimers and say it's not a space for therapy just to protect themselves or their liability. But for me, as a clinician identifying myself as such, I felt a little uncomfortable by those type of Clubhouse rooms where people would go in and share their pain, and there was no one out there to really pick them up, right? It was almost for entertainment purposes, and people would listen and even maybe even offer some advice. But at the times where a clinician would be in a room with someone that is expressing something as vulnerable as trauma, there can be certain dangerous aspects of it where the person can be harmful to themselves or others. And we want to be able to prevent that situation from happening. And Clubhouse really doesn't provide that space. So I think it can be very dangerous when we use spaces that weren't designed for disclosure, right? And for vulnerable conversations that aren't necessarily being held with a mental health provider that's either face-to-face through telehealth or in person with the individual.
Thank you. And I want to just expand on that more because there are a lot of disclaimers, right, that a lot of mental health professionals have put on like their profiles, but it still doesn't negate you from even opening up a room or having a conversation where you are inviting people to share. So I always feel that you should be intentional, like with language, right? And how you're asking people to come into the room first by words.
Most people do that, right? To protect themselves from the legal aspect in case something happens. But at the same time, there's the ethical aspect that kind of lingers in the background, right?
Correct.
So since there isn't really that much that most boards or organizations have right now, like defining what your standards are for social media, there's so much room that hasn't been regulated. So while we are clinicians in our regular lives, there's issues in regards to like being interstate, providing services to people who are not necessarily in your state. And sometimes people assuming even when they say you say you're not providing therapy, that because you're a clinician, that you're providing this. And I think that right now we're seeing also the kind of boom of the life coach. And there's so many like clinical people going into that space, but there are others who are in that space providing. We saw, I think you sent it to me, like cognitive behavioral therapeutic life coaching. So it offers the word that kind of, there's a line of what therapy is. While they're not necessarily providing that, using the language of therapy to lure individuals who are ignorant and may not necessarily know better. And I think that can have really detrimental effect to how people either view the therapist or the clinicians providing those services or how they view receiving mental health treatment in the future. Especially as people of color, it's very dangerous for us to not necessarily be provided therapy by mental health professionals. because we already have so many stigmatizing barriers that prevent us from seeking treatment that we don't need that additional barrier.
Thank you. So I'm going to do a quick pivot to address right life coach. That is something that has come up a lot. And I've been in lots of conversations and there are a lot of rooms right on Facebook and clubs that have had those conversations. And I always feel if you want to help somebody, you want to help somebody, right? And the helping profession can be done by several ways. But it's about knowing your role, right? And staying in that lane in reference to how you are supporting someone. So yes, the concern is when you start to see, because there are different levels to life coaching and different terminology. When I started to see cognitive behavioral coach, trauma coach, I was not aware of that. And of course, this is all on Clubhouse. And I'd be interested to know what the training is and what they are being tasked to work on, because it's two different modalities. And I know some great coaches. I know some people who have worked with coaches for various reasons. But when you start to merge the two, then it becomes problematic because you're not trained and to identify the things that a licensed mental health professional would. So now that you have another social media outlet such as Clubhouse, and you're starting to see this a lot, I'm just concerned about do no harm. And where does that conversation then come in reference to, are you doing harm when you are creating these spaces? Or even let's just say on TikTok, I'm not on TikTok, or Instagram, and you're asking for those types of conversation. There is no confidentiality. I've also seen where people will open up a room and say, this is a safe and confidential space, and there are 500 people in the room. So I'd like to know, what are your thoughts on that?
Obviously, confidentiality goes out the window in those type of spaces, especially on Clubhouse. If you're in a necessarily room of 500 people, one, you don't know who else is listening. Even though the names are there, people cannot necessarily represent themselves correctly, utilize photos and other names that they may not necessarily have in real life. In addition to that, the other part of it is, in these rooms, people can screen record. No one can necessarily control what your phone does. And right now in the beta form of Clubhouse, people are screen recording and passing them to other people, the audio, right? I've seen people put them in sometimes Facebook groups and other places that kind of take them out of Clubhouse. And no one needs for them to kind of sign up to an area and they believe that they're in a confidential safe space and someone weaponized that elsewhere. And doing no harm, even though it's the medical model, it's something that social workers and other mental health professionals typically follow. And it's important for us to not give people a false representation of what we can offer. And I feel that by saying that it's a confidential space is not necessarily safe by nature. And because we can't offer that on a platform that we don't necessarily have control on or know how it necessarily works. We don't know if the Clubhouse rooms are being recorded and how somewhere else. So their Clubhouse is so new that we don't really have all the information. And for that, we should err on the side of caution.
So when you're thinking of those of us who are tasked to know better, right, and are still doing it, that's problematic. But then thinking about those who are vulnerable, that maybe have a number of situations going on in their life, we've all had to start to work from home or be more quarantined at home because of COVID. So it created a lot of vulnerability for a number of people. So you want to be able to connect, but you want to make sure that you're doing it in the right way. Now, I do know Clubhouse did make a change. You are not allowed to screen record. So if they notice that your phone is or your device is screen recording, you will get an alert on your device for that. However, it doesn't stop someone from, like I said, I have an iPad and someone can take their phone and hold up another device and record. Because if you go on Twitter, there are lots of screenshots of who are in rooms. And there are lots of snips of recording that are going on. So
I can be in the Clubhouse room and have my phone on speaker and there can be multiple people in the room also. So while we see certain individuals in the room, doesn't necessarily mean that's all that's in the room or that's all that will stay in the room. So it's very important for us as clinicians, especially those that are licensed, I feel, where you mentioned the responsibility we have, it's a heavy responsibility. It's one of the reasons the state trusts you to take on that professional responsibility. And I feel like we shouldn't go chasing popularity and lose our licensure. We worked way too hard for it, right? And I think that that's the most important thing, to not only protect the individuals we serve, but to make sure that we protect the thing that it really and truly serves our livelihood.
And it could be, again, there's pluses and minuses to it, right? And using the opportunity to reach mass amount of people to provide valid, helpful information is fine for educational purposes. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think all the different social media platforms can be used in that way. But when you are starting to intentionally invite people to come into your space to share very traumatic, very private things that could then in turn traumatize or concern other people who are in the room and you have no way to control it, that's when it becomes problematic. And it's something that continually happens. It happens often. It happens daily. I'm hoping that they can find some way to regulate it, or I'm hoping that no one gets hurt. But it's something that continues to happen. There are mental health professionals on Clubhouse who've held town halls. I have, to address this, just to give a heads up, a conversation. And sometimes it's the same people who are attending, who are sitting in those rooms, are the same ones who are holding those spaces, which is unfortunate, right? I'm not there to regulate anything. But as I continue on and just even this conversation, I'm just thinking for myself, is it something, a platform that I need to continue to stay on? But I keep, my rooms and my conversations very general and broad in topic.
I think you highlighted something that was really important, right? Is using your platform responsible. If you're not being responsible within the use of your platform, that's where it blurs the line, where it leans into the unethical space. So if you're using it to educate other clinicians on how to necessarily use their platform, that's a wonderful thing. So individuals who may not know, or individuals who need correction, even though we can't regulate, can learn a proper way to utilize social media is wonderful. If Clubhouse becomes about you, or your Instagram becomes about you, and everyone has to come to you, that isn't really client serving, right? It's not client centered. Therapy isn't ever about us. But I feel like social media has become so much about the individual who wants to chase the most likes or followers and gain popularity. And that changes and shifts why, and one of the reasons why I don't believe that social media is a space that is therapy, can replace therapy in any form, because when it becomes about the therapist, it loses its value. Psychoeducation is supposed to be for the general masses, or for your niche, or whoever that you typically work with, but not necessarily about you. And I think that when you say, come to me, you center you as the individual therapist or provider, and not necessarily the people.
That's a good point. And that's what's happening. I see a lot of things. One, I'm not very good with making videos and stuff like that, so you will never see that, because that's just not my thing. But I started to notice the shift, and I was like, wow, things are really changing. And there are TikTok videos, and it's just what's happening in reference to how we're providing service, right? Are we giving information on where someone can appropriately find service? Are you creating a platform with a thread of people sharing vulnerable things that others can see, which is, again, goes against confidentiality? So I think these conversations are important because things are starting to evolve. This app had been around, I think, since March, from what I was told. I joined it in December, and I was not aware. And I think my second day on Clubhouse, I was emailing the founders, because there were some things that took place in a room that I was not comfortable with. And I was emailing them, and I emailed them often because of just concerns that I had. Very different from Facebook, although there have been some incidents and things that's happened on Facebook as well. In reference to their recording, they do say they record, I think, the first initial parts of a room in case an incident happens, but they don't store it. But there are a lot of other rooms, they have their own thoughts of it, of how it's being stored. So I'm not sure. But I always say that for anybody, when you're using that space, just have self-awareness on what you are going to be sharing in the room. And that's not really the place to share personal stories, to share if you've had traumatic experiences. It's just not the place to do it. And if you are a clinician running, you have to be intentional with trying to pivot that conversation and changing your language when you are creating these rooms. So that way it's not inviting someone to assume that this is going to be a place where they can share. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And the other ethical thing that it also brings up too is the idea of dual relationships. If you're a provider of someone within the community or in therapy, and they see you and they show up in those spaces, are they giving up not only the confidentiality piece, but are you now establishing a totally different relationship with them on social media, right? And we have to be very mindful of that also. And I know that we spoke about it in the recording that deleted, but it was that standard, the technology yes. of social work that barely really defined how you should be acting, right? Or what standards we should have as we utilize social media. And it called for, I mentioned it with some of my supervisees as I became knowledgeable of that, it was a couple, it was like 54 pages, and it was only like a small little blurb. Yes. And one of the yes. things that I had to mention with my supervisees who utilize social media is to make sure that you create pretty much a social media contract. That's the only thing that it calls for. It says pretty much let your client know how social media will be used, that kind of in a sense that they forego some confidentiality because their face and their name may be associated with their account and all of these things, but no one necessarily is doing it. So it's important for us to stay in alignment with whatever our boards and whatever organizations that we're affiliated with, depending on whatever professional title we hold, to make sure that we pay attention to what they will soon be offering in regards to their standards. Because there's so many people in various different boards, like for me, New York City, NASW, but I've attended things for NASW New Jersey. And they're like, look, we're working on creating a standard for social media because it kind of got ahead of us and we weren't necessarily ready for it and really 100% understanding. And now so many people are utilizing, right? So even the TikToks that you mentioned, some of it is really good content, right? Like individuals who know how to dance, I can't stay on beat, right? And individuals who will share really great information about different mental health diagnosis and topics or even advice. And those, some of them I share. They're edited well. They share accurate.
They're very good.
But then others, it's like, we get that you want to share your story and your personal story and connect to other individuals who may be sharing them, but are you oversharing? Is it becoming a space for your therapy? Or is it a space that you're providing for individuals to learn information? And I think that we have to be mindful to not have our personal lives affect the way that we conduct our professional lives. And one of the things that we need to do is create, even like for our organizations and as an individual provider, rules and guidelines of how we will operate and utilize social media within our own organizations and how those who are under us will be served and also are served by us will then be provided those type of forms and information so that they can be knowledgeable about how the way that you'll utilize it also.
Correct. And I remember you said a point that I'm just going to repeat again. It's about not having likes, right? When you get into this profession to help others, but social media has changed, you know, as they say, changed the game, where the more likes that you have on your page, but what does that mean in reference to your ethics of trying to help others? Still, you know, having that platform, but it shouldn't be about how many people are liking your page, especially if you are having your page set up as a mental health professional and depending on the content. Now, there are, like you said, people who have great, great, great information and they have 30,000 followers and such like that. But you also don't want to give the impression for those who are in social work school who are going to be graduating, comparing themselves to, you know, are they going to be a good clinician if they don't have a social media page with 30,000 likes per se?
Very interesting. I've always found that, like, when people chase, like, the numbers, right? For me, I'd rather have 5 followers on Instagram and a 6-figure business that no one knows about.
There you go.
And so many people have that, right? That they always say social workers don't make money or mental health professionals aren't making money. We're making money out here, even being private paid, right? Especially during the pandemic. I've seen individuals with 30,000 followers, 100,000, and they're not making the money that individuals that don't have it, right? So obviously it matters of what your intention is or your outcomes that you're really looking for. And I think that one of the things is for individuals coming out of social work school is that they shouldn't necessarily feel pressured to utilize social media. However, the way of technology and harnessing technology for social good is a major part, right? It's something that even is defined in the social work grand challenges. It's how do we utilize this thing that we don't typically use in our field to do good? But doing good, as you mentioned, means also making sure we don't do any harm. And I think that for new people coming out, they should even be more cautious as they become familiar with what's expected of them. As they take the time to learn the skills, but even get more involved in the practice piece of the profession, that they wait until really and truly sometimes for clinical licensure. That's going to be probably an unpopular opinion because you don't have to have a clinical licensure to jump on social media and share information. But at the same time, it helps in order to get the knowledge and skills we need in order to operate ethically and operate in a way that is backed by more experience.
Correct. And with that, I always say I'm a big proponent that to stay in supervision, staying in social work supervision, even as a licensed professional. So that way you are engaging with someone and making sure that you are still following the rules and or you're having other licensed professionals that can be good accountability partners that you can kind of ask questions on just to make sure that you are following, you know, rules and making sure that you are staying within your scope of practice and your prospective license. I think that's very important.
Yeah, clinical supervision offers so much. In addition to everything that you mentioned, it offers a different perspective. So you may be used to doing things a certain way and someone else may say, hey, try this. And you're like, whoa, I could try this, right? It's something that I'm more than capable of either doing more research or they saw an article that they can share with you. So clinical supervision is a special space for me. It's one of the reasons I started to transition my practice more from therapy to clinical supervision because I love the intimate relationship that is provided through the kind of, in a sense, the teacher and the student, but no one is really the teacher and the student when two professionals are in the room, right?
Correct.
And I think that that's the beauty of it. And I definitely suggest after even getting all your clinical licensure, even if it's once a month, to keep yourself in clinical supervision. So many people opt for peer supervision, but peer supervision doesn't really provide us, one, the liability in case something does happen. And if individuals don't know that we're in these peer groups and we are working and talking about them within these peer groups, we're in a sense breaking confidentiality. So we want to be mindful in those peer supervision groups to not necessarily overshare or to share confidential information, especially if our clients aren't aware that we're in a peer supervision group, but to keep our clients informed that we are actually in clinical supervision probably is the better choice.
I'm a big proponent of it as well. And I think especially after just my experiences on Clubhouse has just really made me pushing more like, okay, we need to start having more spaces with licensed professionals, with having these conversations. What does it mean that there's a new social media app and how do we engage and how are we are, you know, mentoring and providing support and learning opportunities for our peers when it comes to this work, because it's so popular. There's people on it from all over the world. So that's very important.
I feel like that's also the responsibility of like an NASW. I think that these educational trainings should not necessarily be only sent to just people who are like willing to pay for CEUs. This is information everyone should have or know. So I feel that it is a responsibility for us to maintain those memberships and stay involved in professional associations. And it's the responsibility of those professional associations to provide its members with ethical ways in order to maintain those kind of new emerging things that are coming out, including social media within our field.
I agree. And that's very important. And being a part of that membership and emailing, asking questions, that's when this can start to change. And I'm hoping that there will be some conversation in reference to these, how we are engaging with these social media platforms, specifically Clubhouse, because it's audio-based, it's a little bit different. But there are a lot of mental health professionals that are on there, and some doing some great, amazing things, providing great resources and great information. And then you have some where it's like, oh, okay, I'm not going in that room. And it's for a number of reasons. I'll see a title, I'm like, okay, nope, and then just scroll back on. So a couple last questions. When you're thinking of anybody that is looking to speak to a mental health professional, what advice would you give to someone if they're trying to seek, and you know, and they feel as though that they want to be able to talk to somebody? What would be some ideas or tips that you can give for any of the listeners who feel as though, you know, maybe I should try to connect with somebody to talk to a professional?
For connecting with a professional, if you have insurance, it's best to contact your insurance, find out what your deductible and copay is, and also find out if what your in-network and out-of-network coverage is, so that you can start to create a snapshot of how much therapy will cost you. Oftentimes, individuals will call people, and they would like different people in various different spaces, especially in private practice. And they'll say, we don't take your insurance, or we'll take your out-of-network coverage. And they don't have the answer if they even know what their out-of-network coverage is. So I think that one of the places that you can start is right there. Your insurance company can also give you a list of providers. Psychology Today is probably, for me, I consider still the best site to go to look at providers, because it allows you to see their picture and a little bio about them that they've created, a little snapshot, and also see areas of specialty. And you can also search by insurance. If you don't have insurance and are Medicaid eligible, you can usually go to your local hospital and work with their clinic and see a provider as you are working on a Medicaid package. So it's important to know that there are local clinics associated with most major hospitals, not only in the metropolitan area, but also in areas that aren't typically considered metropolitan areas. And I think that one of the best ways to do is to ultimately read their websites, read their bios, get familiar with them, give a call, right? A lot of therapists offer free initial assessments or free consultation call and see if you're a good fit. And one of the ways to recognize if you're a good fit is to have them kind of tell you what they do. See if they're offering a service or they have familiarity with what you're seeking, right? Are they someone that specializes in that area? I think that one of the best ways for even people of color to seek therapy is through, especially Black women, through like Therapy for Black Girls. There's also organizations like, I tend to stay away from BetterHelp. So I don't think that necessarily is the best way, because with BetterHelp, they provide therapy by text. And no one needs to be texting a therapist all day and night. That's a sign of boundaries need to be put in place. And while that platform does provide that, that's not necessarily the way. So there are various different ways to get involved. But usually, if you have insurance, start off with your insurance before you seek any of those websites.
Thank you so much for that information. And my very last question is, how would you describe yourself as a positive professional?
As a positive professional, I see that there is opportunities and possibilities are endless for not only our professions, but also for individual clients. And I model that in my work. I'm a firm believer in abundance and hoping that I can leave a legacy that offers a positive light.
thank you so much again for doing this interview with me, my first interview, because I didn't do interviews last season, but I definitely said I wanted to do something different for this season. And every month I will be interviewing someone who I feel is a positive professional. And of course, I definitely wanted to start with a fellow social worker. And I really want to thank you for the great work that you are doing in our community. You've been a great resource to me, and I really appreciate this. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to you tuning in to another episode. Make sure that you've subscribed to this podcast and don't forget to click the like button. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Stay safe and be well.